So we are still talking about deadlocks today, and don't think I'll need the whole class for talking about deadlocks, but we are done with prevention and avoidance. So we spent quite a bit of time over the banker's algorithm, and then we moved on to detection, which is the more practical form of dealing with deadlocks. So only if you have one instance of each type of resource, you can convert a resource allocation graph to a weights for graph. Why is that? Well, if we take a look at a simple examples, if there's only one instance, the one instance is either allocated or not. If it's allocated, then somebody could be waiting on that instance. If it's not allocated, somebody does not wait on that instance. But multiple people could be waiting on that instance. So this, that graph, which is a resource allocation graph, actually correctly depicts that P1 and P2 are waiting for resource R1. But in transition, they're really waiting for process P2. Although they're not explicitly waiting for process P2, they're waiting for a resource to be available. There's only one copy of that resource, and that has been taken by P2. So P2 borrowed the library book, you want it. Are you waiting for the library book or are you waiting for P2? Same thing. So the weights for graph kind of disposes with the resources and says P1 is waiting for P2, P3 is waiting for P2. What if the resource had two instances? R1 has two instances. This is taken by P2. And P1 is waiting for the resource. Well, this cannot happen because P1 will get the other resource. Right? But let's say this happens because I augment the graph. The other resource has been allocated to P4. So now P1 is waiting for a resource. One copy of that is with P4, one copy is with P2. Which process is P1 waiting for?
Either one.
So that is not depictable in a weights for graph. Why do I say so? Can I not draw if I draw this, does this mean P1 is waiting for P2 and P4 or P2 or P4? There's not a good way of saying this is an AND relationship or an OR relationship. And in effect, cycles, if I force this kind of a graph and say I have a cycle, no, maybe you don't. If it's an OR relationship, this one, when satisfied, this edge goes away and the cycle doesn't matter. So it gets muddled. This is not the right way of doing it. So we do not mess with resource allocation graphs with multiple resources. This is not okay. This conversion is okay. So But then that is the classical, more common use case. That is resources like semaphores, like memory, like whatever, are single instances which are allocated to something. Given that that's a common case, especially where deadlocks are a problem, which is database systems, and these resources are tables, are records of a relational database, are various lockable units, you need to have a weights for graph. So you'll have hundreds and hundreds of processes maybe or whatever, tens of processes, and these are processes, they are waiting for other processes, and it creates kind of a jumble, and maybe in this particular case, does it have a deadlock? I didn't draw it very nicely. Do we see a deadlock? What is the condition for deadlock? Does this particular graph, have I drawn it right? Yeah, I've drawn it sort of right. Does it have a deadlock? No. Why not?
No circular.
No circular. How do you know no circular? A trick question. Because you can see no circles. Because we humans are visual creatures. We can like look at it and go, I couldn't find a circle. Okay. But let me change this to maybe I'll take this guy out and just say it was this way. Now we can see a circle here. And in this circle, we can say this guy. Okay, so here I have a cycle, a circle, or the circular dependency between three processes. However, this thing affects a lot of processes. So these three are involved in a deadlock. So they will never progress anymore. What about this guy or this guy? What's going to happen to this process? What do you think? It'll never get the resource. So what do we call this? Well, we don't have a term for it. I'll invent one. It's an affected process. This is not directly participating in the deadlock, but the effects of the deadlock is spreading to processes that have no part to play in the deadlock. And this is an example of why deadlocks are really bad. You can say, like, whatever's wrong, these three people have committed some kind of a sin, they are paying for it. No, a lot of other people are paying for it. So we don't want deadlocks. Now, going back to what I said last class, It's called a necessary and sufficient condition. Cycles in a resource allocation graph is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. There's a subtle difference between these two things. Necessary Is there really a difference between these two statements? Necessary and sufficient condition? Sufficient? Necessary means you have to have no deadlock, no cycle. Sufficient means if there's a cycle, there's a deadlock.
No.
Same, no what? If there's a cycle, there's a deadlock. If there's not a cycle, there could be a deadlock. No, it says if there's not a deadlock, there could be a cycle. If there is a cycle, there is a deadlock. If something, then something. If the if part is false, second can be whatever. So if. If there's no cycle, there may not be. If deadlock, there's a cycle. No, I think I wrote that wrong. Cycles are sufficient. If there's a cycle, there's a deadlock. If there's a cycle, there's a deadlock. Have to have a deadlock. Okay, I'm a little confused about the sufficient condition. I'll have to look that up. Does it say you have to have a cycle or you have to have a deadlock to get a cycle? One or the other. Cycle is necessary. I'm talking about the sufficient. Necessary. If there's no cycle, you don't get a deadlock. Essentially, cycles and deadlocks go hand in hand. No cycle, no deadlock, no deadlock, no cycle. Both ways. Unlike in a resource allocation graph, if you have a cycle, you may not have a deadlock. If you have a deadlock, you do have a cycle. So cycle checking is irrelevant in a resource allocation graph. You can check and find a cycle, it doesn't tell you much. Cycle checking is the way to do it in a weights for a graph. Okay, now, so there's a weights for graph that's being maintained and you want to find deadlocks. So you just do a cycle check. Sounds easy. How do you do a cycle check? There's two issues here. How do you represent a graph on a computer? And how do you run an algorithm to do a cycle check on that representation? Let's make it easier. We represent graphs just like we draw it on paper. Here's a graph. Now, how do you cycle check? If it's a simple enough graph and I'm a human being, maybe I can find it. If it's a very complex graph, as a human being, I may not be able to find it. But I want a non-human, no eyesight, just the representation can traverse links, and that's what an algorithm is, should find or not find a cycle. How do you do that? I'm sure it's been covered somewhere. Do you recall how do you do cycle checking? Yeah? Louder.
Huh?
Louder.
You look to see if a node's child, one of the child is pointing at the node.
That would detect a simple So you go by nodes, look for a child. If the child is not pointing to the node back, you don't have a cycle. If the child is pointing back, okay, you found one. But I have to go find both ways. That is, I need to know whether there is a cycle, and if the answer is no, there isn't, it has to be really no cycles. Yeah.
Okay, I get two pointers, and the first pointer, each time it goes two steps, and the second pointer, each time it goes one step. And if they meet together, there is a cycle.
Two pointers starting two places.
No, at the same place.
And so it'll chase. Why do we need the second pointer?
So they can meet together.
I can just say the second pointer goes zero steps. And the first pointer goes one step.
Yeah, that works.
That'll work too. So that's simpler. And actually, it's simpler than a general graph because there's only one outgoing edge per node. And there could be a cycle or not, but you can start at any node. No, sorry, I drew this wrong. In a Weitzwar graph, you can have only one outgoing edge from a node. And there can be lots of disconnected pieces. So I can look at it from... What I wanted to say was... There is no breadth-first search here. You know about the terms depth-first search, breadth-first search. What happens when you do a depth-first search? Where do you even start? The root. I've drawn a graph. Which is the root? When does a graph have a root? When it's a tree. Now, there is nothing saying this is a tree or any general Weitzwar graph. So how do you go about doing depth-first searches? Yeah. Yeah, that's what I meant. Depth first traversal. Search traversal.
Well, I mean, depth first traversal is used to detect cycles within a graph, not like your standard binary
and whatnot. A tree will not have a cycle.
I was just looking this up because I remember back at CSC 3.
Yeah, it's a depth-first search, depth-first traversal also. Depth-first traversals do all kinds of things. Breadth-first does the minimal spanning trees and all kinds. There's like a plethora of graph algorithms. So in this sort of a graph, you're better off doing a depth first traversal starting at any random point. You don't even know where to start. There is no route. So you pick, or the representation of this will be a table, an adjacency matrix. You might as well pick the first entry. It's just as good as anything. So you go here, and you start traversing, and you hit the roadblock. There's nothing there. Okay? So all you do is mark these guys. And then you go and pick an unmarked node and start traversing. And you stop if you get to a marked node. But you, if you find that your marked node is actually the starting point, you mark the things later. If you can get to a starting point, that is, you found a cycle. Okay, so what you're doing is checking each node that is not marked once and going deep. There's only one way. There's no multiple outgoing edges. There's only a single outgoing edge. So you can only go depth first. And you keep doing that. So you'll get a cycle. You've got to be a little careful. There can be multiple cycles, completely separate. So you may want to keep doing this until you found all cycles or you run out of nodes. And then we can say if you're going depth first traversals on graphs, multi-rooted obviously, and if you get a cycle it's not rooted, you're coming back to the beginning point wherever you are, then what's the complexity of this?
N squared.
Why did you say N squared?
Because the worst case scenario, we're going to go over every single node first, twice, before we say it's not cyclic or first.
Okay, if you go over every node twice, that's 2N. And you probably won't go over every node twice because you're going to ignore a lot of the marked nodes. But so it's either 2n or it's n. And 2n is n order. Okay? So this is... Now, I wrote down, scribbled down per detection because that's important too. You're going to look at n nodes, if there are n nodes, which are n processes, at least once, maybe twice. And so it'll be linear in the number of processes every time you do a cycle detection. How many times do you do a cycle detection? That we don't know yet. So, notice that in operating systems, almost every, we make special care that every algorithm in an operating system is constant time. We don't have time to mess with linear. That banker's algorithm was n squared or n cubed, actually. That's pretty bad. This is linear, that's pretty bad. Because you're overdoing this, and the more complex it gets, you spend linear amounts of time. But generally, in algorithms, linear is fine, because after all, you've got to look at all these things. But linear is not so fine in operating systems. Thankfully, we don't do this in operating systems. Scheduling. You just pick the first process on whichever queue. You don't go hunting. Memory management, you pick a free frame. How do you pick a free frame? You maintain a free list of frames. Constant time. Searching is a bad idea. Okay? So anyway, with deadlock detection, you've got to do cycles. Cycle hunting. Each cycle hunting will take you in. If there's absolutely no cycle in the graph, there's not even any edge in the graph, it'll still take you in. You're going to go through everyone and say, nothing to see here, nothing to see here. But visually, you can immediately say there's nothing going on. But actually, you have to examine each and every one. Okay? There would be an eager version and a lazy version. The eager version says, if there is no cycle in this graph, a cycle can appear only if a link gets added. Otherwise, there's no cycle. You have to assume there's no cycle in the graph. Initially, there's no cycle in the graph. Nobody is running. Every time a link is added, a cycle may appear. But if a link is added, the cycle will appear down that link, if there is any. Right? So you don't have to cover the whole graph. Every time you add a link, follow the link to see where it heads. Traverse it. If you come back to the point where you started the link from, you've got a cycle. So, however, this is an optimization which is obvious to us that it'll run faster. It's still linear. Why? Because that link can go a long way all over and maybe not even end up in a cycle. Right? You have no idea how deep it is, and it may come back, may not come back. Either way is fine, has its positives and its negatives. If you're eager, links appear very, very often, and they disappear also. You don't have to worry when they disappear. So every time somebody does a P operation, every time some resource is asked for and it's not available, you do a depth-first traversal. That can get expensive. However, so you can say, let's not do that. Let's have something like a timeout or a certain number of links, use some of the metrics to trigger cycle detection. In which case, you've got to do a full cycle detection, that is, you'll examine every node to see if they've participated. Because cycles have not happened, or they've happened, you don't know where. It's not that the last link caused the cycle. Somewhere a priori before that, detection kicked in, a cycle may have happened. So this will be, each run is going to be more expensive, but you're doing far less runs, hence it's going to be faster. But watch out, a cycle, once it happens, is holding up resources forever and it's spreading. So you might get a problem here. Okay? So I cannot say eager is better or lazy is better. Both has its pros and cons. And that's up to fine-tuning the system. Now comes the interesting thing. We find one cycle. And if somehow we know that there was no cycle until this link got added. That information may or may not be relevant. That information is relevant in the sense Is that true? That may not be. Yeah. Now the question is, how do we get this cycle is going to live forever? That's not something we can allow. So what are our choices in the matter? What do we do? I'm trying to resolve a deadlock. Yeah.
You can make like that, whatever that node needs priority, so like just give it the resource so that like it will resolve to you.
I can choose some node. Which one do I? Okay, there are two issues. How do we resolve this? And if I need to slap somebody, who do I slap? Okay, two different things. Do I need? What is the way to resolve this? Without pointing fingers. I know I have to pick some victims, but before picking victims, what am I... If I told you, I'm going... This has the most priority. Then what do we do?
Give it the resource
that it needs. Okay? So what you're saying is that now how? Give X, so I don't know who's X, let's say this is X. Give X the resource that it needs. How do we do that? Because our recipe rule book said no preemption. To give it the resource, I've got to take it away from here. We don't have this luxury of doing preemption. But you're going like, if I can't do preemption, I cannot resolve the deadlock. It's going to sit there. So I must be able to do preemption. So preemption, since it's not allowed, maybe there's a different technique, like really, really bad preemption. Why is preemption not allowed? This guy's gotten a resource. I just decide you're not allowed to use this resource anymore. That would be fine if this was a human being and you had powers over it. It's not a human being, it's a program. Programmer wrote it, I got a resource, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. How do you modify the program to say, oh, well, I won't use that resource now? Right? You get the picture. Programs are very strict following of rules. You can't just decide to change its environment or change a certain variable in there from outside. So I'm still beating around the bush. I need that cycle gone. That cycle is not gonna working out for me. So give somebody the resource means you take it away from somebody else. But that resolves the cycle. I can't take it away from somebody else. The only way I can take it away from somebody else is really this drastic thing. So preemption is not possible, but termination is. Involuntary termination. So you terminate a process because if you take away a resource from a process, it doesn't know how to execute. So if it doesn't know how to execute, we won't execute it anymore. So if you terminate a process, what happens? You essentially will forcibly take off everything it owns. Because it has acquired these resources, it has reached this point in the program. Now it's not going to do anything with those resources anymore. Then you can get rid of all the resources, forcibly remove them, reallocate them, and do we need to terminate? There are so many processes in that deadlock. How many do we need to terminate? Kill them all, kill one, I wrote one. Kill them all or kill one? What do you think? Kill one. Yes, because if one is gone, one link is gone, there's no cycle. But the thing's waiting. Let them wait. They'll figure it out. So killing all of them will also get rid of the cycle, but that's overkill. Killing one of them is good enough. Okay. Then the moment you say kill one, you go like, which one? Least priority. Okay, obviously, as you can see, they're all conflicting things that I wrote down there. And all of them are fine, and yet not so fine. Least priority, how do you know the priority? Do you have a priority? Some systems do. Or rather, I want importance rather than priority, unless if you equate importance with priority. Is this priority CPU scheduling priority? In which case it's meaningless. But sometimes high priority CPU scheduled processes have more importance. But in a lot of systems, in database systems, there's lots of transactions going on. They're all equal priority. So priority can be, maybe you assign them arbitrarily, or you can choose certain characteristics to decide their priority. The oldest one has the highest priority, or the lowest priority, or the youngest one has the lowest priority, or the one with the most resource. What sense does all these opposites mean? If I kill the youngest one, I'm losing the least amount of work because I'll have to redo it. Okay? However, if I always kill the youngest one, I have a huge starvation problem. It'll start up again, get into a deadlock, and get terminated again. If I kill the oldest one, that also could have a starvation problem because it might do a lot of work, and if it gets into a deadlock, it's going to get killed. And during the point it got to deadlock, it's holding a lot of resources. It's not clear whether youngest one is better or oldest one is better. Maybe youngest one is little better. With the most resources, this makes a lot of sense in a way. You've got a ton of resources. The resource that caused a deadlock is only one. You got this, somebody wanted one of yours, and you wanted something which caused this cycle. But you got more. Somebody wants some others of yours, so there's other dependents which are not part of the cycle. If I kill you, all these processes will get freed up. They will start executing because you gave out so many resources. Then when we restart you, you might get through, or you'll have to regather all these resources, giving you a lot of time to gather them, and the chances of getting into deadlocks are also higher. Least amount of resources, again, least amount of work done. There's a correlation between these two and these two. Maybe. Answer, we don't know. And I'll just say, muddy the waters, that if you're worried about starvation, you'll do aging. If you do aging, that means we slowly mark things that I shouldn't want to get killed, you might get into a situation where all the processes in that cycle are aged and you're not supposed to kill them. So there is no good escape route out of the recovery mess. In these cases, sometimes we will just say random, that we are not accountable. In fact, the other thing is, I forgot to mention it here, this one is the last edge. That means this guy is responsible. So all these edges were there. That is the process which put in the last one, the nail in the coffin. So do we hold that process responsible and kill it? Answer, that's why. This guy is just as responsible. He was holding the resource. This guy was just as responsible. He was down the chain. Just because that was the last guy, should that be killed? So there is no good answer to this. Whatever you say, I can come up with a counter example saying that's not a good idea. But this is the easy idea. You just add the link, check a deadlock, blow this guy off. Okay. Detection.
Oh. I thought it was defection.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about detecting, so it's detection. In WFG. That's what we did. No, we're going to talk RAG. Okay, so in that case where you cannot make a weights for graph. Deadlock detection, yes. What if you have a resource allocation graph? And we've talked about it. Cycle detection in a resource allocation graph is not productive. Cycle means may or may not be deadlock. No cycle is good. There's no deadlock. But if you get a cycle, it doesn't mean anything. So how do we handle resource allocation graphs? So let's do it visually first. edges. Okay, what did I scribble there? Why did I do that? You know, in a resource allocation graph, if you go back to my original, there could be a request edge. That means I want this resource, but there is a resource. So it will flip over. So flip them over. Unless if there's no resources here, then it... So let's take a look at the stable edges, not the transient edges that can be flipped over. So those are not relevant. So we take a resource allocation graph which has the static edges. Things are waiting for things. And then this can wait for this, that sort of a thing. And this doesn't have a cycle, but we'll go with this. Now, this sort of a graph is always maintained in the operating system or in the database system because you need to know who has what and who's waiting for what. This is your record keeping. In order to do a deadlock detection, you're going to mess this graph up. So don't mess up the record keeping graph. Make a, at the point that you want to do a deadlock detection, make a copy of the resource allocation graph, a temporary copy, so that now we can just delete edges and things like that. Okay? And verbally, what I'm going to do is if there's a process with no outgoing edges, we just delete this. If I delete this process, it'll get back this edge. So first go in and delete all processes with no outgoing edges, and hence it'll delete all the incoming edges and a bunch of resources will get freed up. Then those resources that got freed up and their request edges satisfy those requests. Yeah. Rank, R-E-G. This one?
No, the last word.
Oh, edges or outgoing. Okay. Delete processes with no outgoing edges. What if there is no process with no outgoing edges? I mean, every process has an outgoing edge. Your host, that means it's locked up. No, nobody can execute. If nobody can execute, there is at least a cycle somewhere mucking things up, or maybe more than one cycle. You've got a deadlock. Okay? But there will be no outgoing edges of people who are executing. Delete them. They may have incoming edges. That means essentially, you're killing off processes. You're not really killing off processes. You're pretending to kill off processes and releasing all the resources they have. So then you delete all the incoming edges to those deleted processes. These are dangling. And hence, so what did you do? You threw out some processes, their incoming edges disappeared, some resources became available. Now there are request edges into those resources. They disappeared because they reversed the direction. Now, since they reversed the direction, certain processes now have no outgoing edges. Or you might have all processes that remaining have outgoing edges. But again, you go check for processes with no outgoing edges. And keep repeating this. You will end up with either nothing, everything gone. Or you'll end up with a few processes, or all of these, all of which have outgoing edges. Okay? Yeah?
Do you just pick a random process to get it that's requesting? Or do you...
At which stage?
At the end, where you give the resource to someone that's requesting.
Oh, yes. If multiple processes are requesting, you can give it to anybody. And then you can argue why giving it will not change anything. So, yeah, if there are multiple requests, give it to one of them, random. Some processes still have outgoing edges, not some. Anything that doesn't have outgoing edges have been deleted. So processes will survive this massacre only if they have outgoing edges. So all remaining processes have request edges outgoing from it. They want something which is allocated already. Now, this means you do have a deadlock. But you don't know which processes are involved in that deadlock. And then you do a cycle detection amongst them to identify a cycle which is the folks that are involved in the deadlock. Okay? And then you follow the previous things. But of course, this is kind of visual. This is not how computer data structures will work. If you had a graph and an eraser, you could do this. Okay? So if you really wanted to do this, which thankfully you may not need to, a resource allocation graph can be represented as two matrices, an allocation matrix where who has what and how many. a request matrix, which is who wants what resource, and a third matrix, which is unallocated matrix. Or remaining matrix, or that has your remaining resources. And with these matrices by traversal, you can find out which process has no requests. And go and take the stuff that's in the request in the allocated matrix, zero it out, delete that process. When you zero it out, you add back to the unallocated or available matrix. And then, from the available matrix, check the request matrix to see if some requests can be satisfied. Satisfy them. Then look for processes which have no requests. You can do it. This is the non-visual proper keeping matrices method. But now you can transform that algorithm into a matrix algorithm with three matrices that you can take care of. And then you'll have to do the cycle detection, where this is the request edges and those are the... You basically have to follow the request edges and the allocated edges. Yeah. Okay? And after you've detected the cycle, it's the same story as before. Kill off one process based on some metric you have, and hope for the best. So yeah, the banker's algorithm is not practical. Prevention is not practical. Deadlock detection is the one that is chosen as practical, but it has a lot of if-then-buts, and it's not easy. Okay, I'll take questions, and after that we'll talk about input-output. Yeah, I didn't even write it. Unallocated. Or let's call it available.
So the viewable matrix is, it represents processes that are available or resources?
Resources. Oh, this won't be a matrix. Sorry, you're right. How many are available of each resource?
So that's a table, right?
They're all tables, but this is a vector. Those are. This is an array. These are two-dimensional. So that gives you the picture of a resource allocation graph, and you can do the detection in there. Same algorithm as before. You just have to transform that. What did I say? Look for processes with no outgoing edges. Look for processes with no requests. If there's all zeros, then that process we can delete. It means you go to the allocation, things that are allocated on that process, and zero them out. But that will cause an increase in the available. Since this causes an increase in the available, you then match it with processes which have requests to see if you can allocate them. When you do that, some of the processes' requests will disappear. And as you allocate them, you update the allocation matrix. So you do the same thing, but you don't have the visual, you have numbers. Right? And yeah, we could write out that algorithm, which I'm trying not to.
number of available processes?
That's the number of available instances of each resource. And these matrices contain how many instances of which resource which process has or wants. Yeah.
So is detection and recovery the most practical solution?
Yes, that's the most practical solution. Yeah, it doesn't look like it, but that's the most practical solution.
And OS uses prevention?
Database systems. OSs don't have a deadlock problem because we can preempt stuff. And what was the other reason? We don't have programs which does, we avoid hold and wait, and we definitely avoid circular wait. And basically, preemption takes the cake. That anything you need, you throw, take it out from somebody, back up the storage, and be done with it. But concurrent programs do have a deadlock problem, but we don't detect the deadlocks. We just ask the programmers to write deadlock-free programs, which means either don't do hold and wait or don't do circular wait. So threads programming can get you into deadlocks if you mess up your semaphores or monitors. So that becomes the application developer's responsibility. So operating systems do not have deadlock detectors, but deadlock detection is part of an operating systems class. It's mandatory that you know what deadlock detection is. Any more questions?
So, a process can have like up to three resources.
This is an example. You can have hundreds of processes, hundreds of resources. This was just a sketch. So that I'm trying to avoid writing the algorithm. Okay, input-output. Now, I should call it input-output or storage management. Essentially, I'll be talking about disks. But the deal with disks is that the concepts carry over into networking, which is input-output, packets in, packets out, keyboards, printers, any device, cameras, audio, all of these are input-output devices. Some have input only, some have output only, most are input-output. They have the same characteristics as disks, but disks are easier to model, and they do both input-output, and they kind of have the same structure that they're slow. Networks are slow. No, we have very high-speed networking. Doesn't matter how high-speed the networking is, it's much, much slower than CPU speeds. So by slow, I mean comparable. Is it comparable to CPU or memory speeds, which run at gigahertz rates, whereas networking generally doesn't run at gigahertz rates? Or even if it does, that's a throughput issue. Not, you still have to wait for various large packets to go in and out. But this is not a networking class. We're talking about input-output devices, which means that if there's a program, you may read some data, or you may write some data. And this is read and write are library functions which boils down to some system calls, and you know that your program will run to here and then will miraculously wait for the data to be available and then continue. So there's a wait involved in both cases. If you write, You may not immediately continue unless if there's enough space in the buffer, but there might be a wait. Now, how is this run, stop, go, and where does it go in case of a disk? How is this managed? Because programs are heavy users of input-output. But this input-output gets taken care of by some magic. What is that magic? Okay? Now, this is still a little sketchy. I need to get into more detail. There's something called fold I/O, which is not used anymore. But that's the starting point of all input-output. You somehow come here, and inside the data operating system, you can check whether the data that the program requested, is it available. How do you know it's available or not available? Where is the data? That's the detail we'll have to get into. And if the data is available already, then copy to variables. Now, when you read data, I didn't write it properly. You have to pass a pointer or a buffer or some return value where you'll get the data. And these are variables in the user space of the process. So when you issue the read call, it somehow goes, finds that data somewhere, copies it into the process memory, and then allows you to go. Similar for the write. If you say write the string, somebody is going to take that string from the memory of the process, put it somewhere else, and then somehow send it to a disk or send it over the network or send it on a printer or on a screen. Something has to happen. All that is part of the operating system's dealings. So how do we model that? We can always say that it's polled. That means there is a busy loop which does the checking, location, etc., waiting. But if there's a busy loop, then this is going to run as long as the data is not available. How long is the data not available? You have no idea. If this data is a keyboard data, it depends upon how quickly whoever types it. Sometimes we don't type it. It takes a while to think about it. During this time, the process is running on the CPU. Even if it gets time switched in and out due to time quanta, it's taking up full time slices on the CPU. Complete waste. You don't want that. If it's network data that you expect it to come, it depends on the speed of the network on the internet it's going to arrive. You think it's going to arrive. And until it arrives, you spin. This is much worse than any spin lock or anything like that. Because there's significant delays in inter-arrival network packets or typing or even disks. So let's just start. The whole thing becomes which kind of traffic are we talking about? What input? What output? It's a little simpler if we take a specific case like a storage unit. Like there are two kinds of storage we use. Regular spinning disks and SSDs, solid-state disks. I'll more focus on the spinning disks, but we'll talk a little bit about solid-state disks. So I've got a few minutes left. What happens with the disk is this is looking from the top of a disk, or if you take the cover off, you'll see a platter. Actually, it's multiple platters. So we're not interested in the exact design of the disk, is how many platters, how fast do they spin, and how do we record information on it. But just the concept that there is the spinning thing, and there is a read-write head that comes out and can locate itself at any one point, and each point being a track. There's a stepper motor that can make it move from track to track to track. And when it sits on a track, these sectors fly under the disk, under the head, because it's rotating. And any time a sector passes by under that head, it can read the signal off of that sector, which contains data values, zeros and ones. Okay? So the hardware of the device has certain registers by which you tell the hardware which sector data you want. Do you want to read? Do you want to write? Where does the data go? And then there are control registers, which status registers rather, which tell the operating system what's going on. And then you've got to write the software, which is a driver, which will actually perform the transfer of the data. And very similar things happen with keyboards, printers, cameras, and networking. So we will take this as the example. We'll talk a little bit about solid-state devices, polled I/O, interrupt I/O, I/O controllers, and how does it interface into an operating system. Okay? Right, then you actually reach the end of it.
Yeah.
No process that is requesting no resource.
So we cannot have it.
Oh, yeah, then there's no deadlock. So processes that are not requesting anything are deleted.
So
you delete everything, there's no deadlock.
So why can you say that there is a process that is requesting no resources, and but he has some resources which is allocated to it, So, I mean, if there is resources that allocated to this process,
you're going to free it up.
Yeah, but I mean, I think this is like a contradiction.
Yes, what you're saying is, do I need to free up all this? I can see nobody is requesting anything. I'm done. That's true. Perfectly fine. But if you just ignore that part and you go to the kind of not, that's an optimization. The other way is that you just check for processes that are not requesting, delete that. Get rid of the, give back the resources.
Yeah.
If there's nobody requesting, all processes will get deleted. Resources will get put back. And your terminating condition is that is there anything left? There's nothing left, we are done. It's just more work. You can optimize it by just first looking at, is there anybody requesting? Both will lead to the same story.
So the resource release is similar to like the free, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you're doing this on a piece of paper or on a copy. You're not actually releasing resources.
Okay.
You're not killing processes.
Okay.
You're pretending, it's running a simulation to see, can I finish?
Okay.
And if so, you have no deadlock.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're saying it's possible with this procedure?